This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As President Obama sends 30,000 more troops to Afghanistan, he may also expand the not-so-secret U.S. war in Pakistan. According to reports in the New York Times and elsewhere, the president delivered blunt messages to Pakistan's military leaders recently. If they do not go after Taliban sanctuaries, they can expect to see more American drones over their territory and possibly special forces troops as well. According to another report in the Times yesterday, the messages got a cold reception. The interests of these two formal allies coincide in some places but diverge in others as the U.S. tries to surge to success in what Americans view as a very long war in Afghanistan. Pakistan takes a longer view and sees America's current enemies as its friends who will play a big part after the U.S. withdraws. In a moment, NPR senior news analyst Ted Koppel and David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent of the New York Times, join us. If you have questions about what's happening here and the stakes involved, give us a call. We'd especially like to hear from those of you with experience in Pakistan and Afghanistan. The phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the program, a former infantry officer on SRP, the Soldier Readiness Program. But first, wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Ted Koppel joins us now from his home in Maryland. Ted, always good to have you with us.
I recommend hot tea, lemon, honey, and a shot of scotch.
After the show, Ted, after the show. And David Sanger is here with us in Studio 3A. He's the author of The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power. Thanks very much for coming in, David.
Thanks, Neil, and good to hear from you, Ted.
And David, I have to begin by asking that the recipient of these warnings is almost as interesting as the messages themselves.
It sure is. The messages that the president has sent came actually, they began to be sent before his speech at West Point. He sent General Jim Jones, who's the National Security Advisor, out to deliver sort of the tough part of the message. Secretary of State Clinton had been out the week before to deliver the nice part, which was the United States envisions a broader strategic relationship with Pakistan, one that doesn't lurch from crisis to crisis, attack from attack, doesn't have us withdrawing from the region and then coming back into the region. Then General Jones came out and said, look, if the president's going to commit another 30,000 troops to Afghanistan, bringing the American total to about 100,000, and of course another 40, maybe 50,000 of foreign troops, he does not expect that they can be attacked each day from the tribal areas of Pakistan or from Quetta, where Mullah Omar's forces are believed to be. And so he laid two options out. One is that the United States and Pakistan rout out this part of the Taliban, the what's called the Afghan Taliban, together, or that the United States do it on its own schedule in its own way.
And this, according to Jane Perlez's report in yesterday's newspaper, got a very cold reception from the Pakistani military.
Yes, what Jane reported yesterday, and I really fascinating piece, was that a letter had been written back to President Obama, and the message had been sent that Pakistan would focus first on the threat that it sees to its own government, which is from the Pakistan Taliban.
And indeed, they've recently launched offensives first in the Swat Valley and now in South Waziristan.
That's right, which the United States has been very complimentary of. But part of the argument that the Pakistanis have made is that these attacks have so occupied their military. In fact, they pulled troops off of the Indian border to mount these, which is a big change for the Pakistanis, that they couldn't imagine a situation in which they would be free anytime soon to go after the Haqqani network, which is one of the groups of Afghan Taliban.
Said to be in North Waziristan.
Said to be in North Waziristan, and the one that is launching some of the fiercest attacks on American and NATO troops that are over the border in Afghanistan. The difficulty with this is that the Pakistanis, on the one hand, are doing something the United States has urged them to do for many years. On the other hand, they are not going after that portion of the Taliban that has been directing attacks on Americans.
And this presents all kinds of problems, Ted, for an administration. It is committed to trying to find a solution in Afghanistan. It believes it cannot do that without settling the problem of the sanctuaries that these forces enjoy on the Pakistani side of the border. Yet it also fears that if it pushes Pakistan too far, it may cause the collapse of at least a moderately a pro-American government in Islamabad.
Let me first of all, Neil, give a totally unsolicited compliment to David Sanger and a recommendation to your listeners that they go out. David, is that book coming out in paperback soon, I hope?
The Inheritance, yes, will be out next month.
Well, there you go. Go out and buy The Inheritance, because if you want to understand why reporting is not about what is most recent in the world, but rather what is most important, you can read David's book, and among other things, you will learn more about why Pakistan is so important to U.S. interests than just about anywhere else. It's a newsier book than anything you find between the pages of your newspaper. There you go, David. You owe me big time.
Boy. Now, dinner's on me, Ted.
There you go. Now, Neil, as to your question, in a curious way, I think the Pakistanis are almost showing a rather sly sense of humor here. In their public assumption that the United States is going to be pulling out of Afghanistan. Certainly the president left the impression that was going to happen in his West Point speech, but listen to what the president said very, very carefully. First of all, he's only talking about the possibility of beginning the process in the summer of 2011. There is no indication whatsoever that the United States plans to withdraw troops that are already in Afghanistan. Merely some of those that are now being sent in as the surge. But Pakistan, for its own reasons, is acting as though the president had quite clearly said, we're out of here. I don't think that the United States is out of Afghanistan for many, many, many years to come. But the Pakistanis have been burned before. They were burned in the 80s after they helped the United States with the war against the Soviets. And they felt betrayed by the United States. They felt deserted by the United States. And they're making it very clear they're not going to buy that particular package again.
And that, if they take this longer view and just dig in their heels, David Sanger, what is the United States likely to do? Because that threat, if indeed it's been made, well, you do it or we'll do it.
Well, you know, it's a very practical sort of calculation the Pakistanis are going into here. They believe, as Ted suggested, that the United States is going to pull out sooner or later, whether it's 18 months or two or three years, that at least the military presence will be reduced greatly.
Actually, let me just interrupt for a second, David. I don't think they believe it. I think they just choose to say it. I think they understand that U.S. interests in that region, and we can get into the reasons for that later, I think they believe U.S. interests are such that we're going to be around for a very, very long time. I just think it serves their purpose to pretend that they believe that.
Well, I certainly believe that there is going to be a U.S. presence in Pakistan and in Afghanistan for a very, very long time. Civilian presence, a training presence. What the Pakistanis worry about is how long the combat unit presence will be there. And, you know, you hear different things from different members of the administration on this. The president gave a speech, as Ted said. Then you saw 3 or 4 days in which the Secretary of Defense was having to explain that the United States would not be pulling out very quickly. You talked to other members of the administration who argued that the surge shouldn't happen, and they say that it will be undone quite quickly. The Pakistanis are certainly taking advantage, as Ted has suggested, of this ambiguity. And the Pakistani view is that as the United States begins to withdraw, the Indians, who have already invested about $1.2 billion in southern Afghanistan, are going to move in, and that the Pakistanis will be completely surrounded. And they've said as much to American visitors as far back as the last year of the Bush administration. And so they are making an argument, as Ted suggests, in a very self-interested way. But they believe that the Afghan Taliban, and Haqqani included, are their insurance policy for the day that the United States begins to withdraw.
Not Mr. Karzai, who is, of course, whose friends are in Washington, D.C., but Mr. Haqqani, the son of the old Mr. Haqqani, who's in North Waziristan, and indeed Mullah Omar, the head of the Taliban, the Shura, the Quetta Shura, as it's usually called, and that's in the capital of Balochistan.
Well, when the Pakistanis look at President Karzai, who they ostensibly, you know, they've gone out of their way to try to show some support for. In fact, President Zardari went to the inauguration of President Karzai last month. They see a leader in Afghanistan whose authority barely extends beyond the walls of his palace. And frankly, when many American officials look at President Karzai, they see the same thing. So the Pakistanis don't believe, and I don't think the United States could ever convince them, that President Karzai, this many years into rule of Afghanistan, is about to change his stripes, either on the corruption side or on the gaining authority over Afghanistan.
What prevents, David Sanger, the United States from carrying out these drone attacks, which have been going started in the Bush administration, have accelerated in the Obama administration? And these are bombing attacks, bombing raids on another sovereign nation, which, you know, this an act of war by any definition. Nevertheless, some of these attacks have been directed at the Haqqani network, and yet Balochistan and the Quetta Shura are apparently off limits.
Well, every time that the United States does these bombing attacks, and every time that there are some civilian casualties, and if you went into a very crowded city like Quetta, you would certainly have more civilian casualties, it sends anti-Americanism in Pakistan to yet another high. And you don't believe that it could get higher, but it does. And so these are very risky in that regard. And at the same time...
And troops would be even more so.
And troops would be even more so. In fact, the one time that the United States did a special operations raid at the end of 2007 into Pakistani territory, the reaction was so severe that all of a sudden the Pakistanis closed down temporarily the United States' ability to move goods into Afghanistan
through
for the troops.
Through the Khyber Pass.
That's
yes,
right.
Indeed. We're talking with David Sanger, the chief Washington correspondent of the New York Times, and with NPR senior news analyst Ted Koppel about Pakistan and its connections to the war in Afghanistan. If you have experience in that area, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Cowden. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Pakistan is critical to supporting the war in Afghanistan. Supply lines run to U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan across the Khyber Pass through Pakistan. Pakistan is also home to the logistical network of the Afghan Taliban. It's vital to both countries fighting the war in Afghanistan, to both sides in the war in Afghanistan. Now the United States is pressuring Pakistan to move against the Afghan Taliban, which finds sanctuaries in rugged tribal areas of Pakistan. And so far the Pakistanis are saying no. We're discussing the consequences of this with David Sanger, the chief Washington correspondent of the New York Times, and NPR senior news analyst Ted Koppel. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And let's see if we get some callers on the line. And this is Christian. Christian with us from Long Island.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Go ahead, please.
Mr. Sanger actually already kind of touched on the topic that I was going to say, but I guess I'd just like to reiterate and maybe hear a little more in detail. How is Pakistan thinking about this relationship with us long term? Because they see us developing the nuclear alliance with India. They see us positioning our Navy primarily in the Indian Ocean. They see long-term links with India, which is obviously a good move because they're the big power coming up in Asia. But they also see drone attacks on their fringe. And I guess I would say is how solid is the support of the state and against and also of the people?
A projection today that, in fact, India would be the most populous nation in the world in 2025. But anyway, David Sanger.
Well, the Pakistanis are quite nervous about the development of the relationship between India and the United States, and quite angry about the nuclear deal that was signed at the end of the Bush administration, which for the first time ignored the fact that India, like Pakistan, is not a signatory to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty and allowed the resumption of nuclear trade between the U.S. and India. Pakistan has not been offered a similar deal, because Pakistan was the source of the greatest nuclear proliferation we've ever seen, the AQ Khan network. But there's more that angers the Pakistanis as well. You know, President Bush would do almost anything for the Pakistanis after 9/11, except the one thing he couldn't get through Congress, which was a low-cost way for them to bring their textiles into the United States, because many senators from textile states and some members of the House as well objected to it. And so the Pakistanis feel that the United States shows up with demands but doesn't show up with much of a way to solve unemployment.
And Ted, the Pakistanis would say, if you are our friends, how can you be India's friend at the same time?
Well, it's worse than that. There is a very real level and possibly with some reason, level of paranoia in Pakistan with regard to the number is not quite clear, somewhere between 60 and 100 nuclear warheads that they have in that country. And they are terrified that the United States, particularly in terms of the idea of putting combat troops on the ground, special forces in particular, they're terribly nervous that the United States at some point, to protect our own interests, may try to seize their nuclear capability. I think a great deal of what is going on here has far more to do with the India-Pakistan relationship than it does with terrorism that originates in Afghanistan. What is really behind almost everything here is that India-Pakistani mutual distrust.
Christian, thanks very much for the call. Let's see if we go next to, this is Vernon. Vernon with us from Fremont, California.
My question is this. Isn't it true that there are many factions within the Pakistani government that are favorable to increasing the influence of the Taliban in Pakistan and, in fact, are supporting the Taliban in many ways and providing a sort of counter to the efforts of the military to engage the Taliban and fight them and so on, isn't it the case that unless there is some kind of regime change, those factions are going to remain, and consequently, isn't that ultimately Mr. Obama's plan to create a regime change to take out the Zardari government?
David Sanger.
Well, I haven't seen any evidence that there is a plan by the United States to take out President Zardari's government. There's a lot of concern in the United States that President Zardari's government may fall of its own weight. In fact, even
just a
today,
ruling in the Supreme Court today that said his protection for against prosecution was unconstitutional. So therefore, he is able to be prosecuted. Therefore, he may have been elected improperly, and we may see a court case challenging his legitimacy as president.
And he has been losing so much power lately that in order to hold on to his post, he's been giving up many of his responsibilities and powers, including, most importantly, two or three weeks ago, giving over to the prime minister his right to sit on the National Command Authority, which is the group that oversees those nuclear weapons that Ted was talking about. But your caller's right. The Pakistani government is deeply divided. They are fighting both sides of this war and supporting both sides of this war. They were, from 9/11 forward, and President Bush never really wanted to come out and say so publicly. He always wanted to support President Musharraf, who was the military dictator who became president and ultimately resigned a year and a half, 2 years ago. And the result of this is that you have three big factions. You have Zardari. You have the opposition political leader, Nawaz Sharif, who used to be prime minister and was prime minister when Pakistan set off its nuclear tests and was overthrown by Musharraf. And then you have the most important institutions in the entire country, the military and the ISI, the main intelligence service. And both of those, but particularly the ISI, are ridden with contacts with the Taliban. And periodically, American intelligence officials show up with tape recordings of the ISI officials talking and plotting with Taliban members, and they hand them over to Pakistani officials, and they sort of shrug and say, well, nothing's perfect.
And in point of fact, Neil, that isn't quite as insidious. I mean, it is insidious, But the fact of the matter is, 20 years ago, we were very happy to have the ISI working with Taliban and with al-Qaeda, because in those days, we were collaborating with them in the war against the Soviets. The problem is, you've still got the same people there, and the sense of the Pakistanis and many in the Pakistani military is that these relationships are going to be essential in the continuing struggle against India.
Let's see if we can go next to, this is Harris. Harris with us from Gainesville in Florida.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I had a lot of things to say, but I'll just condense into a couple of very specific incidences in between the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan, which leads to, I need to get some answers for it, because actually it is, let me tell you what it is. When the South Waziristan operation started, the seven posts which were on the Afghanistan side facing the Pakistani border, manned by U.S. troops, were vacated and abandoned. And they just left. And nothing is done. So obviously when the pressure came on the South Waziristan, nobody was mining those posts, and these people went into Afghanistan. Now, bigger problem than that is I was recently in Quetta, and a friend of mine took me over there. Early dawn, we went to a place called Bab-e-Azadi. It means door of friendship. This is the check post between Pakistan and Afghanistan. And at 8 o'clock, excuse me, in the morning, the door was open. It was a big iron gate. It was open, and there was a flood of close to 2,500 Afghanis who came from north, entered Quetta, unchecked, no papers, nothing. Mm-hmm. And when this flood was closed, another 25 or 3,000 Afghans went from Pakistan side into Afghanistan side, unchecked. Happened. And then my friend told me, he said, the most interesting part was that we got on top of a container truck, and he handed me binoculars, and I saw on the north side where the Afghan side was, there was an IFAS checkpost with an IFAS friend flag, plus the Dutch flag over there. And those troops were just hanging around over there. They were not doing anything. So what my issue here is, this is the actual problem over there. No, there's no check of people going north and south and east and west from both sides. So if somebody can put this issue in front of the Pakistani military and the IFAS and the Central Command, why is this happening over there?
The ISIS is the international force that's NATO, effectively.
Yes.
I can't vouch for the you say you were there, and I believe your eyes, but I can't vouch for the accuracy of the abandonment of those posts. But nevertheless, David Sanger, we hear this is a porous border. I didn't realize it was quite that porous.
Oh, it's about as wide open a border as you can imagine. I mean, first of all, it's an extraordinarily rugged border. So if you can imagine all of the problems that the U.S. and Mexico have patrolling their borders, and you add some of the world's most rugged mountains, take away a good number of the forces, and you have a sense of how people move across. And while I can't vouch for what our caller describes, it's very similar to things that you hear all the time. This is a border that was created by the British. It bears absolutely no meaning to the tribes that are out there. And I think that any solution to this problem predicated on sealing that border off is probably doomed to failure.
In fact, some people say what we're really talking about is a war with Pashtunistan, a country which does not exist but has tens of millions of Pashtuns on both sides of that border.
That's right.
Indeed. And David Sanger, the other part of this we have to remember, the Haqqani network is, it's technically part of the Taliban, but it's got its own interests in the eastern parts of Afghanistan as well, and is believed to run several provinces there effectively as the sort of the shadow government. Nevertheless, these are also the people believed to be harboring al-Qaeda.
That's right. And as Ted points out, these are the people. Haqqani's father was one of the leaders that the United States and others supported during the war against the Soviet occupation in Afghanistan more than 20 years ago. Because the Haqqani network is believed to harbor al-Qaeda, the Obama administration has said that this is not part of the Taliban that the United States would try to negotiate with. And so that leaves really only the choice of fighting them or ignoring them. And, at one point in the discussions on the Afghan policy in the Situation Room, President Obama is said to have commented to his aides, you know, it doesn't matter if we put 30,000, 50,000, 80,000, 100,000 troops in Afghanistan. If you don't solve the sanctuary that allows the Taliban to retreat back into Pakistani territory, it's simply not going to work.
We're talking with David Sanger of the New York Times, and of course, Ted Koppel is with us, NPR senior news analyst. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Ted, as we look at this question, if the sanctuaries are to be addressed, if indeed the Pakistanis are reluctant to go after this Haqqani network in North Waziristan and against the Quetta Shura there in Balochistan, is the Obama administration going to be forced to go after them themselves? And what kind of repercussions could that have in Pakistan?
Well, God help them if they do. I mean, as bad as things are in Afghanistan, I shudder to think what it would be like if we were running ground operations in Pakistan. And understand, for example, the Pakistani army has been conducting major operations in South Waziristan. And the assumption is that what they've succeeded in doing is driving many of the Taliban from the south into North Waziristan. So they're up there now in that region. And the real question is, has the Pakistani army really accomplished anything? Jane Perlez had an interesting piece in the Times in which she made reference to the fact that there actually was another story in the Times that made reference to the fact that there is no way of knowing how effective it was, because at least there are enough people to create terrible terrorist attacks throughout Pakistan, which are leaving the impression and are intended to leave the impression, you've been coming after us, you haven't accomplished anything.
David?
You know, this is a very familiar problem that Ted describes, and he's absolutely right on it. After the invasion of Afghanistan following the 9/11 attacks, where the United States, with about 600 CIA and, of course, the Northern Alliance, came in and threw the Taliban out, for about the next year and a half, when you went to Afghanistan, you would get a standard U.S. military assessment of where things were. And the assessment by the end of 2002 and early 2003 was that the Taliban had been eviscerated. Not that they had moved 50 miles over the border into Pakistan, but that they were gone for good. And in fact, this is what the NATO countries were told as the United States tried to draw them to come in as peacekeepers.
And nation builders.
And nation builders, right. Something that the Obama administration, a phrase the Obama administration is now not using. But it's exactly the phenomena that Ted described, which is you look around and you say, they're not there now. They must be gone. Well, they must have moved.
They must have moved to another part of Pashtunistan. Indeed. Was there any kind of timetable on these messages that were delivered to the Pakistan's military and intelligence services? How soon does President Obama insist that the Pakistanis do something or else?
I haven't seen the messages themselves, so I don't know if there were specific timetables. But I think the impression that was left was that if there is no action by early spring, late winter, early spring, then the United States would begin to act. And Ted raised just the right question, which is, it's one thing to do this with drone attacks. It's another thing if you're actually trying to go in and move troops in. And, you know, it raises the question that one American general raised with me a year and a half ago. He said, the problem with Pakistan is, how do you invade an ally?
Well, how do you conduct a bombing campaign against an ally, too, which That's is exactly right. what they're doing.
Right.
And indeed, we keep hearing reports as recently as last weekend. Another high-ranking member of al-Qaeda has been taken out. We're not quite sure who it is. It's not number one. It's not number two. But it's very important. And yet, nothing much seems to change.
That's right.
David Sanger, thank you very much for being with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Neil.
David Sanger is the chief Washington correspondent of the New York Times, and Ted Koppel gets 10% of his sales on The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and Challenges to American Power. Ted Koppel, thank you, as always, for being with us from your home.
It's only the paperback rights, and they don't make much money.
Now you tell me that. Ted Koppel is the senior news analyst for NPR, former anchor of ABC News Nightline, and he joined us from his home in Potomac, Maryland.